Step right up. I am Dr. H.H. Nutmeister, visiting your fine frontier town for one day and one day only. I've studied on 8 continents. I've braved the terrible swamps of Mindora to bring back the miracle root they call Peruna. In San Lorenzo, I obtained a nerve syrup that cures Saint Vitus, dance, and prostration. I was summoned by the Silesian king to treat his son for softening of the brain and loss of manhood, which I remedied with gentian infusions. You, sir, don't be shy. Step right up so I can treat your hideous deformity.
Actually, I don't have a deformity. I'm fine.
Of course you're not. I detected a hitch in your get-along. You suffer from hysterical chilblains, or I'm a Mongolian dromedary.
It's true that I have a little bit of arthritis in this knee, but these remedies of yours sound like snake oil.
And right you are. Snake oil is just the thing for a sad case like yours. And I'm not talking about those proprietary snake oils like Dr. Tyree's Tonic that lose their potency on the shelf. No, siree, I'm talking about fresh snake oil made on the spot. You take a step back there, son. Behold, I remove from the bag a Tortuga Island diamond rattlesnake, a beast of great ferocity. I place it here in this steam press and pull the lever. And out from underneath my contraption trickles snake oil. Swallow it down while it's fresh and good, my man. And then step over and hand my assistant Injun Joe some currency in the amount of $20.
Really? If I drink this, my arthritis will be gone?
Well, let us just say that you will never be heard to complain again. While he's drinking that down, ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to behold yet another miracle. Sound which is conducted through the waves of the air. The speaking voice of a man you cannot see. And now the spokesman for Platt's Chlorides, a sponge bath for the insides, Colin McEnroe.
Actually, I'm no longer a spokesman for Platt's Chlorides. It just didn't work out. I think Salma Hayek is now their spokesperson, but I'm not 100% sure about that either. So we're going to talk today about quackery, but also about the way in which certain things kind of hover on that knife's edge between quackery and accepted medicine. As you may have heard me say before the news, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, a journalist friend of mine did a lengthy investigation of acupuncture, at the end of which he concluded that it was absolutely nothing. There was nothing to it. It had absolutely no usefulness or any benefit. Well, you can walk into almost any hospital today and get acupuncture. They're usually over the integrative medicine department. And I just was on the Mayo Clinic website this morning and we're reading all about acupuncture. So things do change a little bit. Our attitudes do change. But we're also just surrounded all the time, as we have been, as our guest today will tell you, as we have been pretty much from the moment there was something that was identifiably accepted medicine, there was almost immediately an unacceptable medicine. So we're going to talk about both of those things. Our guests today include Erica Janik, a historian, writer, and executive producer of Wisconsin Life at Wisconsin Public Radio. She is the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. And Dr. Eric Boyle, he'll be joining us by phone from Maryland. He's a medical expert and historian at the National Institute of Health. He is the author of Quack Medicine, A History of Combating Health Fraud in 20th Century America. And joining us now from the Yale studio is Dr. Stephen Novella. He is a neurologist and assistant professor at Yale University Medical School, well known for his involvement in the scientific skepticism movement. He's also a senior fellow for the James Randi Educational Foundation, where he directs their science-based medicine program. So, Dr. Novella, I'm going to begin with you. We're surrounded all the time now by just, you know, a lot of information about things that sound very promising, but are for the most part not sanctioned by the doctor that we go see, the doctor who's covered by our insurance. And so we turn on the TV and there's Dr. Oz, who celebratedly is talking about milk thistle and some new holy grail for weight loss called Garcinia Cambogia. We read that Steve Jobs treated his pancreatic cancer differently for a while, may have used a special kind of diet and delayed surgery for that reason. We're reading now that the FDA is revisiting the question of how to regulate homeopathic and similar treatments. If you're a basketball fan, you might know that Seth Davis's CBS basketball analyst, son of Lanny Davis, his mother markets a whole bunch of sort of, you know, unsanctioned ionized water and alkaline water that she thinks or says helped her cure her own stage 4 cancer. There's stuff like this all the time. So, Dr. Novella, we're kind of wired for hope, right? We want to believe, particularly if we're not getting the kind of help we think we should get from conventional medicine. We're kind of wired to believe that there's something else out there, something else that might really help. How do we make discernments? Do we just trust our doctor and assume that all this other stuff that we hear about is nonsense?
Well, it's really difficult. I won't pretend that it's easy to filter through all of the information out there, especially now with the internet. I mean, people are overwhelmed with information. And there's no substitute, I think, for being one, having a basic level of scientific literacy. So you at least could give this sniff test, as we say, to claims. Does it even make basic scientific sense, or is it just magic? And also some basic critical thinking skills so you could, you know, be an informed and a discriminating consumer. I mean, right, we kick the tires before we buy a used car. Wouldn't you want to have some basic information about a treatment before you buy it, before you subject your health to it?
So I decided to kind of let myself float along like plankton on the internet. I started at one of these websites and clicked through to some link on another one and read some comments on yet another one. And I wound up on a comment thread where I read this. My good friend had a very aggressive malignant brain tumor removed almost 3 years ago this coming November. The surgeon was not able to remove it completely, or she would have stroked. However, her neurosurgeon gave her no hope. That's in capital letters. She was offered radiation, but he said that she would live no longer than 3 years. Well, she chose nutrition, but she also drinks water that is generated with collagen 2. Trademark symbol. She is a chemist and knows about science, and she also knew that the government uses this particular generator at NASA. The nano silver water cannot be patented because, like oranges, it's natural. She has no neurological deficits, and her tumor is gone! Exclamation point. And on and on. Now, you've read a million accounts like this, but if I were a cancer patient who hadn't really been given much hope by my physician, by my oncologist, I might be looking at this and thinking, well, what have I got to lose?
Yeah, so my first advice to anybody reading stuff like that on the internet is to completely ignore any anecdotal evidence like that, any testimonials. They are far more likely to be misleading, and they may be deliberately misleading. I mean, it sounds like you were giving the implication there that maybe this is somebody with a vested interest in selling this product, but even if they're sincere, that's not enough. Anecdotes like this are completely misleading. We just don't have enough information to know why that person got better, what their real diagnosis was, what other treatments may have been involved. And of course, people who die aren't around to give their testimonials. So how many people took the alkalized water or whatever the magic water is and are no longer around to give their testimonial? Or it just didn't work, so they went on to the next thing. Nobody's going to spend any time telling the world about the treatment they tried that didn't work. So it's massively biased. The only way to really sort through these kinds of questions is with careful observation, what we call science. You know, we do clinical studies so that we could count every person who tried something, and we can control for all the variables and know as best as we could know anything if it actually works or not.
Erica Janik, the process that he's describing right now sounds ideal, but is it the whole history of medicine, or does medicine sometimes evolve because people almost at a folk level start trying something and maybe it works and then talk to other people and spread it around and then ultimately it gets tested? I mean, is medical scientific progress always as orderly as Dr. Novella would like it to be?
I think we all would like it to be that way, yeah. But that just definitely is not the case. And that's certainly not the case in its history. I think a lot of people, particularly in the 19th century, were trying all kinds of things. And the fact that they were trying them and, you know, this kind of anecdotal, testimonial evidence that it worked did lead to people actually doing more rigorous scientific testing of these remedies. And, you know, maybe people were doing things that were crazy and didn't work at all, but they did raise questions and push forward issues that I do think has had a very positive impact on medicine.
Is it possible to draw a bright line at the point where there was something that we could call canonical accepted medicine, and on the other side of that line, alternative treatments ranging from potentially useful or not terribly harmful to out-and-out quackery.
Well, I think you find with the discovery of germs in the late 19th century, as medicine starts moving into the lab, into a hospital, this is really a time when medicine starts to change. It's when mainstream medicine starts to change, too. Mainstream medicine really looked nothing like it did in the early 20th century as it did in the early 19th century. They were doing completely different things. And so I think that's kind of a reckoning period in kind of the early 20th century where a lot of the alternative therapies that were very popular in the 19th century had medical schools, had thousands of followers, you find them start to kind of die down. You know, they're trying to figure out how to incorporate this new science as it becomes more accepted. But it takes a very long time for even American doctors to accept that the germ theory of disease is actually right. They're very skeptical of it. They're not quite sure that it's true and accurate. There's some of that skepticism came from the fact that it was discovered in Europe. People were like, I don't know about those Europeans. And so it really did take some time before even American mainstream doctors accepted some of these things. So, you know, it's not like one day we figured out that germs cause disease and then all of medicine changed. It really was a kind of a snowball effect.
And Dr. Novella, to that point, you know, you've sort of heard me refer to this a couple of times now, but I attitudes evolve. And so, I mean, really 15 or 20 years ago, most hospitals did not have a department of integrative medicine. Most of the ones around where I'm sitting right now do have a department of integrative medicine. And that department may include a whole bunch of things that probably really would have been rejected as quackery even 20 or 25 years ago. And acupuncture, I would assume, tops that list. So what's your take on that? In other words, is that science loosening up its standards and allowing in things of dubious value? Or is it science evolving to say, well, maybe there's some things that we hadn't really figured out all that well?
Oh, I think it's very much the latter. It's marketing. The science hasn't changed on a lot of these things. Like you mentioned acupuncture. It's not as if there's new evidence which made us reconsider our opinion on whether or not acupuncture is effective. In fact, we have been doing more rigorous, better controlled studies of acupuncture, which all fairly consistently show that it works for no indication. After thousands of studies, acupuncture has not been demonstrated to work. What has changed is, as you say, a loosening of the standards. In fact, more than a loosening of the standards, the carving out of a very specific double standard, the whole label of complementary, alternative, now integrative medicine is all about creating this double standard where anything goes, where the rules of science can be loosened. They're specifically advocating for changing the rules of science to allow in weaker forms of evidence that could prove whatever they want it to prove, rather than really trying to figure out what actually works and what doesn't work. This is a triumph of marketing over science and reason.
Do you see, for example, the fact that the FDA is revisiting the question of homeopathic cures? Is that another symptom of what you're talking about right now, or is that just sort of a necessary level of inquiry about stuff that people are going to use anyway?
Well, it remains to be seen. I'm not sure what the FDA really is, what their goal is here. I hope that they're sincere in reconsidering their regulation of homeopathy. Now, homeopathy is pure snake oil. It is water. It is in its, you know, the usual form. There's no active ingredients in there. It's magic from 200 years ago. It can't possibly work. Most people are surprised to find out what homeopathy actually is. And the FDA didn't, although they were given the power to regulate it, homeopathy is are considered drugs by law in this country, which doesn't make sense, but that's the law. So the FDA has the power to regulate it, and they basically just chose not to because it wasn't that big a deal. It wasn't that big a market, and at least the sugar pills are directly harmless as long as there's no contaminants in there. So they decided just not to spend their limited resources regulating something that was so small and fringe anyway. Now it seems as if they're reconsidering it because there's a multi-billion-dollar industry selling homeopathic remedies, and they're thinking, hey, maybe we should actually do our job and regulate these things that we are tasked to regulate.
Erica Janik, I mean, is another part of this, and I'm not even sure I want to talk about homeopathy in these terms, although we can, but even going back to these departments of integrative medicine where you can get acupuncture and stuff like this, some of this, I assume, is kind of audience-driven, right? That people are going to do this. People want this. And to a certain degree, hospitals have thought, well, if they're either going to do it, you know, in some strip mall or they're going to do it here.
That's definitely true. I mean, people have been using and looking for alternative remedies for centuries. I mean, you find in colonial America, people were practicing all different kinds of medicine that some they were telling their regular doctor about, and others they were not telling them about. And so people are doing these things anyways, because, you know, there are gaps in what we know. The science does not explain everything. But humans, I don't know, we don't seem to like that. We don't like uncertainty. And, you know, someone that can make a promise to us, and, you know, if it doesn't seem to cost all that much and we might be able to treat ourselves, that people are willing to try those things. And so I think it is kind of a recognition that people have always been doing this, and they're probably always going to continue to do it.
I want to see, as we go along here, you can call in at 860-275-7266, but I've got a lot of guests here and a lot of phones in use and stuff like that. It would be even better if you were to tweet us at WNPRColin, particularly if you're really mad about something that's been said. So far, definitely tweet us at WNPRColin on Twitter, or you can email me at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. But add Dr. Eric Boyle to this conversation, because something that Dr. Novella just said about homeopathy made me think of another interesting case study that's in your book, something that I hadn't really thought about for a really long time. But if you were going to have like a 1970s theme party, you definitely want to have some Laetrile there, right? Because so Laetrile is this thing that was really supposed to be this alternative cancer cure. I think its big vogue was in the 1970s. And first of all, Eric Boyle, just sort of sketch out the Laetrile story for us.
Well, the story begins with this idea that you can get an effective cancer treatment or cure from a natural source, and that is the pits of apricots. And so it initially begins as very much a classic French therapy, and it takes that trajectory of, you know, being rather easily dismissed and marginalized, and no one really thinks it has any legitimacy. And then as it becomes more and more popular, in a lot of ways, the consumer demand for Laetrile ends up requiring a kind of reluctant response on the part of regulators and scientists who, in their mind, you know, Laetrile doesn't work. It's not, you know, worth investing the money and resources into, demonstrating that. But for the sake of consumer safety and for the sake of, you know, really tackling this question of whether or not Laetrile works, finally, reluctantly, the FDA and scientists at the NIH get involved. And lo and behold, when they conduct their studies, all the evidence comes back and shows it, in fact, does not work. And the response, much as it had been with a lot of therapies in the past, was, patients continued to demand it. And there were people who said, it worked for me, I want it for, you know, my friend. And so even though the FDA finally banned the production and circulation of Laetrile, it continues to be something you can get on the internet to this day.
So this is it's a great case study, I think, for some of the stuff that you're talking about, Dr. Novella, with homeopathy. So in two different ways. One of them is the way that Dr. Boyle is just talking about right now. You've got this thing, and no self-respecting researcher really wants to study it because everybody in the scientific community thinks it's worthless quackery. Why would I spend years of my life working on a double-blind, peer-reviewed study of Laetrile when I already know that it's nonsense? But if you don't study it that way, you've really essentially got nothing to say to all those potential clients that Dr. Boyle is describing, right?
Well, you can always fall back on plausibility, meaning what's the probability that this thing is going to work? What does the animal data say? What do we know about it chemically? What is it biologically plausible? That's what we use to determine what's worthwhile studying clinically? And it's actually an interesting question. Even my colleagues and I debate, is it worth investing in clinical research in treatments that probably don't work just because they're popular? I think Laetrile gives us an answer to that too, and what we see over and over again. When you do the big study and you show it doesn't work, it doesn't matter because people aren't basing – the people who are advocating it at least aren't basing their opinion on scientific evidence in the first place. So giving them the scientific evidence, spending all the money to acquire it doesn't change their mind. They just write it off as a conspiracy. So you've gotten nowhere. The people who knew it didn't work already from the scientific implausibility that you confirmed what they suspected. The people who thought it worked, they ignore it. So you've just spun your wheels for millions of dollars and expending lots of scientific resources.
Although an ergogenic, I mean, another part of every single one of these stories is that part of the narrative is there's somebody who doesn't want you to have it, right? That the FDA is in bed with people selling more sanctioned kinds of drugs, and the AMA is in on it, and everybody's in on it, and there's kind of a conspiracy to make sure that you don't get to know about and you don't get to use this thing, this very natural thing that makes a kind of intuitive sense to you. Of course, God would have put something in apricot pits that would help me.
That's absolutely true. You know, there's always that sense that someone knows something and is trying to keep it back from you. And I think that's something that's played out, in the United States for centuries. And in the 19th century, it was mainstream doctors that were kind of the villains there against the common man. And I think that's still, maybe we wouldn't use exactly those terms today, but I think, there's so much money in medicine that a lot of people get skeptical about it. I think with money driving so many things in our culture, not just medicine, but all kinds of things that people just aren't sure. It's really hard to sort out, what's actually real from what's not, because it does seem like there's this conspiracy to keep this knowledge from you.
Well, so Dr. Eric Boyle, to that end, one of the things that I think is said in your book is that upon subsequent review, one of the things that the FDA or somebody decided was that there was kind of a mistake made by letting Laetrile hang around, so to speak, that it sat around there for a while with people using it. And what the FDA should have done is regulate the crap out of it from the very beginning and basically try to drive it out of existence rather than have people waste their time, their money, and possibly even lose their lives pursuing a treatment that wasn't as good for them as some of the more beneficial treatments. But doesn't that kind of play into that paranoia? In other words, if you turn into Elliot Ness treating Laetrile like liquor during the Prohibition, aren't you more or less feeding the beast that says, I want this thing, I need this thing, and these dark forces are keeping it away from me?
Well, I mean, I think it partly depends on, what position you're in and what responsibilities you have in this, in the whole discussion, because if you are in the regulatory business, then this is part of your work. As much as it might not be something you want to do, it's something that you're compelled to do. And I think part of the problem with suggesting that it's not worth investing the resources in studying something that already doesn't work. I think I would suggest it's a mistake in some ways to argue that everyone already has their mind made up, and no matter what the study says, they're just going to go about their business and do what they want to do. I think there are people who, might start out sympathetic to a new treatment, especially when something comes out and everyone's talking about it and is excited about it, and it hasn't really been studied yet. People want to know whether or not it really works, and in order to reach that conclusion, you have to go through the dirty work of conducting the research, and I think it's a valuable and necessary thing.
Well, there's the research, but then Dr. Novella, then there's also the regulation. In other words, one of the things the FDA could do with a lot of this stuff that it thinks is completely worthless is regulate it, try to keep it off the market. And you sort of alluded to that with homeopathy. I mean, that's another option, right?
Yeah, I mean, I always like research. I have no problem doing the research. It just needs to be tied to regulation so that it gets put to good use. It doesn't get thrown down the hole. You know what I mean? So if we want to study treatments like this, and the other thing is there is, again, let me get back to the double standard. what people don't seem to have a problem with the government and the FDA regulating pharmaceutical companies and regulating drugs and not allowing drugs onto the market unless they've passed a hurdle of safety and effectiveness. I think people expect that the government is protecting them from worthless or harmful substances. They assume that that's already happening. It's only brought up the freedom to use these things when the evidence shows they don't work and somebody wants to sell it anyway. Then they go, oh, well, you can't regulate it. You're taking away people's freedoms. No, we were just actually providing some sort of standard. You know, this is all about standards. We want to have at least a reasonable assurance that the substances we're allowing people to sell as medicine are not poisons, that we can make some kind of statistical statements about how to use them and are they going to be effective? Are the claims legitimate? I think people expect that, but they just fall for this double standard in order to sell the snake oil, you know, the stuff that isn't backed by evidence.
We're going to talk about actual snake oil as we go along here. By the way, the intro, I wrote the intro before I discovered that actually almost everything that was in the intro was actually happened in the 19th century. There were people making snake oil on the spot out of snakes. But we have to take a little break here. Before we do this, just so I don't lose this thread, I mean, I'm way overdue for the break. But Erica Janik, it seems to me that one of the other drivers of this, it seems crazy to say it, but it seems to me that one of the other drivers of these things are famous people, you know, and that even if the FDA decides to regulate the crap out of Laetril or something like that, the next thing that's going to happen is I'm going to read about some movie star or incredibly rich person who has cancer, who went to Mexico to get this because their cancer couldn't be treated in the U.S. And that I read this all the time that, you know, and then I think, well, that person has all the money in the world and all the access to everything that that person could possibly want. And Salma Hayek is wonderful and she uses these cleansing things and, you know, So they must know what they're doing, right? I assume that this is a big part of the dynamic, reading about famous people who go and get this stuff.
That's absolutely true. And that's definitely been true. Again, you know, I think all of this stuff, you know, I can just point back to things that happened, you know, two centuries ago. I mean, the 19th century, people could read about how Mark Twain was using alternative remedies and he would claim that various things worked. Of course, with Mark Twain, it's always hard to tell whether he's telling the truth or not. But, you know, people do put their stock in famous people. I think you're right. People will just keep continuing to use these things because they see that people who can buy the best medicine on earth choose this other kind of remedy.
All right. We have to take a break. If you need to cleanse, now's the time to do it. When we come back, we'll talk some more.
It has nothing of value that's not contained in the food you buy at your supermarket. Investigate before you invest in health services or products. Help stamp out quackery.
And we're back. We're talking to Dr. Stephen Novella, Dr. Eric Boyle, and Erica Janik about the history of medicine, the history of alternative medicine, and the present and future of remedies that are not medically sanctioned, some of which may be useless, some of which may even be harmful. We do have a lot of calls coming in here. I'm going to try to get at least one of them on the air here. Here's Scott in Manchester. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm listening to your speakers, and I'm just curious offhand how many actual homeopathics they use themselves, you know, first-person experiences.
Well, I'm guessing in the case of you, Dr. Novella, none, that you don't use homeopathics.
Oh, I don't use it at all, no. I mean, I know a lot of skeptics have done homeopathic overdoses where they've taken hundreds of homeopathic pills just to show that they do absolutely nothing, although you got to be sure that they don't have contaminants in them before you do that. So, but that's just another appeal to anecdotal evidence. You know, I don't listen to my own personal anecdotal evidence over anyone else's either, because that could be just as deceiving. This notion that it quote-unquote worked for me is the ultimate deception. You really don't know. Even with a proven treatment, when I give a patient a treatment and they get better, I don't know that my treatment made them better because it's an N of one. You just can't know statistically. You have to look at it in a controlled way to really know.
Let's grab another call here. This is Eric in Hamden. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a really great subject. About a decade ago, I took a class called Wisdom in the Healing Arts, and it was taught by a traditional MD who became a holistic doctor. Again, you know, from knowing the guy, it was as much anecdotal and his personal experiences in life as anything else. But Part of this class that I took, he pointed out during the first third of it, the failings of our present so-called Western medicine. Tens of thousands of people die every year. Misdiagnosis, poor application of prescription drugs, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me that pointing the finger at I just think that there's we have to examine all of the failings of all of the systems and take a good hard look at what's going on.
I can anticipate Dr. Novello's response, but let me go to Erica first about this. So one of the things that he's saying is if canonical medical science worked perfectly all the time, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right? The reason that folk medicine, that alternative medicine, that emergent medicine, whatever we want to call it, the reason it exists is because people aren't happy with what they're getting.
That's absolutely true. And that's been true all along. You know, people, one of the things that people complained about in the 19th century is that their doctors didn't spend enough time with them. And, you know, that's exactly what people say now. But then they would, go and see this alternative practitioner who would spend hours with them. And, maybe it was just that hours of attention that actually did the healing. But it is these holes in medicine that leads people to search for solutions elsewhere.
I just want to switch tracks a little bit here, Dr. Eric Boyle. One of the pathways that we've seen in the past for some of these sort of alternative cures or whatever is that they start, particularly in the late 19th century and bridging into the early 20th century, they'll start out as kind of remedies, right, or tonics, and then they'll become commercial products. I mean, most of the cola products that we know today kind of emerged out of this idea of Vin Mariani, the coca leaves steeping in wine, Thomas Edison. Talk about celebrity endorsements. Thomas Edison and all kinds of other mighty minds were big fans of this. And from there, you got to all these things like Coca-Cola and Moxie and things like that. And these were originally marketed as having specific health benefits, right?
Right. I mean, the big shift is, up until, the 1950s, really, for most of these products, the standard position by the American Medical Association was any of these products that are marketed directly to consumers and make claims of any sort of curative properties or even, symptom treatment, all of those products that are marketed directly to consumers should be treated as suspect and are likely quackery. And so issuing that kind of adopting that kind of blanket opposition to commercial products of that sort ended up creating this kind of difficult situation for the medical profession in the 1950s, because that's when really for the first time you have a legal delineation between prescription drugs and what we now think of as over-the-counter drugs. And what happens is a lot of the big drug makers who up to that time were engaged primarily in developing pharmaceutical drugs, especially in the wake of the big antibiotic revolution of the 40s, get in the business of buying up all these old proprietary companies that were selling these products that had been dismissed for decades by the American Medical Association as bunk. And all of a sudden, these are marketed as legitimate over-the-counter remedies, with the compromise being that no claims are made for curing anything. You're just treating the symptoms. And so you're not really competing with the doctor. You're, providing you're kind of a physician's assistant of sorts.
In a way, Dr. Novella, what he's describing there at the outset is there's sort of a reversion to that now in the sense that these days people do go to their doctors and say, I was watching CBS Sunday Morning, and they were talking about Flomax, there are commercials just wall to wall on a lot of these shows that end with ask your doctor if you might be right for, and so we're sort of back to that where the people who make things, these are FDA regulated sanctioned things, but they're creating a different kind of relationship between the doctor and the patient.
Yeah, I agree, and that can be an issue, though it also does tend to raise public awareness of certain important treatments. But let me address a couple of points that were raised. First of all, sure. It actually isn't true that most people consume or pursue alternative medicine because they're unsatisfied with mainstream medicine. That's what everyone assumes. But if you look at the actual data, there have been multiple surveys where people are asked, do you, you know, use alternative medicine? Why do you? And very few people say because they're unhappy with mainstream medicine. They say that they want to try all options, or they were made open to it by the media or by an endorsement or by a friend. I think people just want to be treated, and they don't care what the basis of the treatment is as long as it works. And people like listening to stories because that's very compelling to us. But it's not being driven by dissatisfaction with mainstream medicine. Having said that, obviously there's lots of problems with mainstream medicine. It's a really big, huge, complicated industry, and there's a lot of things that we need to improve. But just because it's not perfect, that's the Nirvana fallacy, just because it's not perfect doesn't mean we completely throw out the standards or we turn to magic. Again, all we're saying is we need to have one evidence-based standard of care that applies to everything and not create this double standard where you allow magic and nonsense without holding it to any standard.
Let me describe a call from Antoinette, who may be one of those people not entirely satisfied with traditional medicine. Hi, you're on the air, Antoinette.
Hi, yes, I am. I have to say, I don't know where this guy gets his information, but homeopathy has been extremely effective for hundreds of years and is very non-invasive and couldn't be more safer than the medications that are prescribed by many doctors that have very deleterious effects.
Well, Antoinette, could you give me a specific example of something that you've used homeopathy for that worked better than conventional medicine?
I could give you several examples.
One would be.
There's many things that you could take. What is it you were looking to help?
Oh, no, I don't need homeopathy. I'm just, since...
But, you know, you have a double standard of saying that, you know, just give it a chance to medicine, but you're not giving natural medicine a chance. Because medicine has been around for many years.
But I was just wondering...
I don't know where you get your information saying that it's snake oil. That is just ridiculous.
We haven't even told the story.
That's a very arrogant man who knows not what he speaks.
Well, okay.
And unless you tried it yourself, really, you shouldn't be putting your mouth where your feet are. You really need to try it and get experience for yourself and see how effective it is before you can go around dissing it and saying how bad it doesn't, you know, work, because it's extremely effective. And that's why people come to it, because it has very minimal invasive side effects.
All right, really I don't mean to cut you off here, but you're kind of going on and on and saying the same thing. We sort of get it, but anyway. All right, so here's what we should absolutely do, apropos of Antoinette anyway, is somebody needs to tell, because the working title we've had for this show for a while is snake oil, and I did not realize that, I thought snake oil was sort of a metaphor, but it turns out, Dr. Novell, I don't know whether you want to be the one who tells this story, but there really was something, there was snake oil that was being sold town to town.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there were multiple products that were literal snake oil. That was a natural, you know, remedy that was very popular in the 19th century. A lot of – at the same time, that meme that's been around for a long time, the idea that things that are natural are magically safe and effective, and there was a lot of appeal to traditional cultures, you know, back in the 19th century in the U.S. saying that Native Americans used this remedy was a huge marketing effect, and people actually just made up treatments and then just claimed that it was a Native American treatment, but that was just all part of the marketing.
But so the snake oil, I mean, they really made something out of snakes, right? I mean, they.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was real or not. I mean, but there was no regulatory control to say that what was on the label was what was in the bottle. But you could certainly, you know, find pictures of bottles of medicines from the 19th century that have snake oil listed as the ingredient or as the title of the medicine. So that definitely was marketed, and that's where the name snake oil comes from.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about the placebo effect and other stuff as well as we continue our investigation into quackery.
My doctor's a quack. Oh, man. When it comes to medicine, this guy don't know nothing about the field. Doc is a quack.
I'm having a really bad day. My electromagnetic thong is interacting with my ionized water. I'm getting these little shocks, and I don't even want to tell you where. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Sydney Lauro. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jenny McCarthy. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff having coffee enemas, actually, no, don't watch that. Visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the past and future of timekeeping. And now, back to Colin.
All right. We are talking about alternative medicine, about quackery, about maybe sort of the gray area that may or may not exist at times. Our guests include Dr. Stephen Novella. He's joining us from New Haven's Yale studio. He's a neurologist and assistant professor at Yale University Medical School. Erica Janik is with us from Wisconsin Public Radio. She's the executive producer of Wisconsin Life and the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. And Dr. Eric Boyle, he's the author of Quack Medicine, A History of Combating Health Fraud in 20th Century America. He's a medical expert and historian at the National Institute of Health. So, Erica Janik, one thing that you have observed, I mean, obviously there's a lot of wasted money in some of these areas, and there are people who put their health at risk either by not using better forms of medicine or by using something that doesn't interact well with the more conventional form of medicine that they're using. But as you look back across the history of this, one point that you've made is that it has been a point of entry, if you go back far enough, for people who were excluded from the medical priesthood, specifically women, right?
Absolutely. Really, the first, second, maybe even the third generation of female professional doctors in the United States came out of these alternative or irregular therapies in the 19th century. In part, it was because women were kind of an underserved market. A lot of women were kind of too embarrassed to go see a male doctor. And even if they did go see a male doctor, propriety often meant that they didn't get treated or examined fully. And so a lot of women were really suffering. And so alternative therapies, all different kinds, really saw women as kind of a ready market. They really were going after women's health. And one of the ways they thought that they could popularize their theory and their treatment was by really welcoming women in. And so women were really welcome into homeopathy, hydropathy, that's water cures, all these different things. They had medical schools. Women could go to these medical schools, could graduate from them, could become, you know, actual medical doctors. And so you find it as a really wonderful point of entry for women to actually have a career in medicine. Women weren't allowed to join the American Medical Association until 1915. And so it was really an area that was kind of closed to women.
So, but Dr. Eric Boyle, one of the potential downsides to this was that women were also being envisioned radically differently from men. I mean, we know that men and women are different, but there were all these sort of catch-all problems that they could have, right? Neurasthenia, hysteria. I mean, and that's how they wound up at these places where, like, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who lived a few feet from where I'm sitting right now, would go to some spa or retreat where she'd be wrapped in incredibly heavy, wet sheets for days on end. Some of this was because there was this sort of idea that women were congenitally frail in a way that needed remedy.
Well, sure. I mean, it's not just unique to having these alternative therapies or patent medicines of the late 1800s and early 1900s being marketed directly to women. You know, this finding a niche market for a condition that is either not effectively treated or ignored by the medical profession is widespread and incredibly pervasive at the time. And a big part of that market is certainly directed at conditions or diseases that were defined along the sexes. And it wasn't just women who had problems identified associated along the lines of gender. You know, there were men's problems as well. There were men's specialists and men's clinics where predominantly venereal disease treatments were administered. I think it's a big part of medicine at the fringes throughout history has been, speaking to the people who are marginalized in one way or another, whether it be, opening up opportunities professionally, or designing treatments and therapies that that are especially for them that have that kind of personalized feeling or character.
Hey, we're running out of time here. Dr. Stephen Novella, one thing we haven't really talked about is the placebo effect. So I have really bad arthritis in both my knees, really bad arthritis in one of my knees. And so I'd be really happy with anything that would make my knee feel better. And so if you put a cup over it and had bees sting it, or if you gave me some kind of quack cure and my mind tricked me into feeling as though my knee were better, I wouldn't be necessarily unhappy about that. I mean, what do we know about the way the placebo effect kind of dances with all these alternative therapies?
Yeah, it's a very complicated question. Placebo effects, you know, plural, there are many different kinds of placebo effects. In a clinical trial, it's anything other than an actual response to an active treatment. And that includes a lot of different things, including the symptoms getting better on their own, or just reporting bias. People want to feel that the treatment was working, or maybe they're doing other things in addition to the treatment that you're interested in. We have tried to unpack as much as we can what goes into placebo effects. One thing that's been pretty clear is that there isn't any mind over matter real healing taking place, although that's often how the placebo effect is sold, especially for treatments where they only have a placebo effect. It's mainly subjective temporary improvement in symptoms, but not any real physical or physiological healing. Pain is probably the most dramatic example, because pain is so distractible, and pretty much anything you could do can distract somebody from their pain, and that will be, you know, become part of the placebo effect. And that's all fine as long as it's part of reasonable science-based medicine. You're not using it to sell magic or convince people that you can cure their cancer.
There is a Connecticut connection, right? In the first medical patent in the United States was issued in 1796 to the Connecticut physician Elisha Perkins for medical tractors. And Dr. Novella, these were things that the doctor claimed could cure sore joints and other pain.
Yeah, it's interesting. At the time, you know, magnetism was fairly new scientifically, so it was like the sexy new sciencey thing. And there were hundreds of magnetic devices at the time. In fact, it inspired a physician, you know, in the 19th century to write a comprehensive book essentially debunking all of the magnetic devices at the times, including those devices. So that's, of course, that just like any snake oil or ultimately ineffective treatment, they're being marketed and sold entirely based upon their placebo effects, because you can, with placebo effects, you can convince pretty much anybody that anything works. That's why it's not discriminating. We need to know that there's some actual effect there, not just the illusion of an effect.
And so, Dr. Eric Boyle, the subtitle of your book is A History of Combating Health Fraud in 20th Century America. I would assume that one of the challenges is that situation in which the patient is basically saying, well, who am I going to believe, you or my own lying knee? My knee actually feels better. You know, don't tell me this is health fraud.
Right. I mean, the techniques that have been used predominantly to combat health fraud or quackery have by and large not been directed at the patient beyond just taking this kind of educational approach. You know, what's striking when you look at the past 100 years of these efforts to educate the public, the people who are involved in this process, the anti-quackery crusaders or quackbusters, as they've sometimes called themselves, kind of endlessly have this faith in the ability of people to see the light. If they were just educated, if they were just sufficiently scientifically literate, then they could make an informed decision. And I think in some ways the failure of that strategy and the failure of that, or the inability to kind of reach that ultimate goal, in some ways encourages us to look more deeply at, you know, what's going on in terms of the appeal. A decision isn't made because people don't always choose alternative therapies because they just don't know enough about them, or because, you know, they are deluded. And so I think, you know, kind of getting over the hump of that inherent bias is a key part of the process in terms of, like, speaking to people directly.
All right. Well, we have to stop now. That's Dr. Eric Boyle, whom you hear speaking, the author of Quack Medicine, A History of Combating Health Fraud in 20th Century America. We've also been talking to Dr. Stephen Novella from Yale Medical School and Erica Janik from Wisconsin Public Radio. Send all of your emails to Josh Nalea. No, you can send them to me. even though you're really mad. I know. Colin, C-O-L-I-N at WNPR.org. Or you could tweet. Just tweet at Greg, WNPR Colin on Twitter. That's a good place. At WNPR Colin on Twitter. And remember, blame Greg or Josh.
Hey, buddy. You tired from going out on the road with all the other snakes and the steam press and the snake oil? Yeah?
I've got something that'll help you. Just relax. There he is.